Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Here's some irony. As unpopular as the United States Congress is, it takes a senator to make the point.
I love working for the people of Indiana. I love helping our citizens make the most of their lives. But I do not love Congress.
Senator Evan Bayh, a Democrat, calls it quits, saying Congress is too partisan, too ugly, even for a two-term senator, even for a son of a senator, to go on.
There is much too much partisanship and not enough progress.
Does quitting in protest shake Congress awake, or just let it wave by to another bipartisan pest? Evan Bayh the enforcer, or Evan Bayh the enabler? On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, February 16th. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in this week for John Hockenberry, and I'm here, of course, with Celeste Headlee. Celeste, the takeaway for me on this is, you know, as unpopular as the Congress is, for a senator to leave accusing the entire Congress of too much rancor, you wonder if it's going to send a message that Washington will listen to, or if they'll just close ranks.
Well, as the attrition rate gets higher and higher, you got to wonder if we're going to have a kind of a different look to the Congress come next fall. Let's get right to the top stories you're following this morning. U.S. officials say they've captured the Taliban's top military commander. Mullah Abdul Baradar was detained several days ago in Pakistan during a joint Pakistani-American raid. He's said to be the second in command behind the group's spiritual leader, Mullah Omar. Baradar is one of the Taliban's four founders. Earlier, we spoke to the BBC Islamabad correspondent, Shoaib Hassan. He said it's important that Baradar was taken alive.
He's a very important member of the current military setup of the Taliban, and he will provide intelligence that can be used on the ground in Afghanistan in the operation that's going on there right now.
Baradar is being held in Pakistan. Meanwhile, across the border in Afghanistan, the battle continues for the city of Marja. It's still slow going for NATO troops, even though officials say about a quarter of the 400 Taliban fighters estimated to be in the town have been killed. Those left have been stepping up their counterattacks, slipping behind U.S. lines and opening fire with rifles and rocket-powered grenades.
Here at home, you heard us talking about it just a few minutes ago. Senator Evan Bayh, a leading moderate Democrat from Indiana, says he will not run for re-election this year. He cited the toxic atmosphere in Congress as his main reason. Now, already this year, 43 lawmakers from both parties have announced that they won't run for office this year. That's up from 39 in the spring of last year. We're joined now by Adam Nagorny, chief political correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Adam, good morning.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Fine, thanks. How much of a surprise, really? I mean, I was in the Senate a week ago. Evan Bayh was introducing major legislation on debt reduction. He's been raising money like crazy. Was this really a big surprise?
Yeah, people around him had a sense that he was uncomfortable with the job and had been thinking about leaving. But the timing of it caught a lot of people by surprise. As you said, he's raised a lot of money. He had petitions ready to go. Tuesday's the deadline for filing. So I think you could say people were really kind of shocked by this.
He was showing a lot of frustration, but didn't really show any signs of wanting to bow out. I mean, people were talking about a race between him and Republican Dan Coats.
Yeah, no, I know. In fact, one of the things that was interesting that was going on, Dan Coats has emerged as one of the leading Republican contenders, and there's been a real considered effort by Democrats, you know, including Evan Bayh's operation, to sort of raise questions about Coats' candidacy, which is a classic sign of a guy clearing the field to get himself ready to run. So it really, really caught a lot of people by surprise.
All right, Adam Nagorny, stay with us because we're going to talk about it more in just a moment.
In Haiti, President René Préval says it'll take 1,000 trucks, 1,000 days to remove the rubble from Port-au-Prince. That means, he says, it'll take 3 years before rebuilding the capital can even begin.
Moving on to the markets now, Asian and European markets are up. Futures are also up. The Dow gets underway at 10,099. The S&P opens at 1,075. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,183. Coming up, we take a look at Mardi Gras music from the classic rhythms to its newest incarnations, remixing Fat Tuesday. That's later this hour. We're also talking about turning what you love to do at home into a paying gig. Could you turn your hobby into a job? 8778-MY-TAKE. You can post to the website at thetakeaway.org.
More about Senator Evan Bayh in a moment.
Good morning. Todd Zwillick here, filling in for John this week. We start out the hour with some more bad news for congressional Democrats.
I love working for the people of Indiana. I love helping our citizens make the most of their lives. But I do not love Congress.
There's a statement that's calibrated to hit on the sentiments of the public. Not many people love the Congress these days. That was Indiana's Democratic Senator Evan Bayh saying he's done with the Senate and will not seek re-election in 2010. That unexpected announcement comes at a time when both Democratic and Republican incumbents prepare for a shakeup in the 2010 midterm elections. Many incumbents are finding themselves in tighter races than expected, especially on the Democratic side, probably because right now Americans are a lot like Evan Bayh, and they're not feeling much love at all for the United States Congress. Back with us is Adam Nagorny, chief political correspondent for our partner, the New York Times, and also Lisa Mascaro, Washington correspondent for the Las Vegas Sun, who covers Senator Harry Reid, the majority leader, who's in a tough race of his own back in Nevada, a Democrat fighting for his seat. Adam, back to you just to start. You have a piece in the Times this morning. You say that Bayh's announcement increases the chances of a Republican takeover of his seat and gets the Republicans closer to really knocking down that Democratic majority in the Senate. Why does Indiana carry so much weight as a bellwether here?
Well, two things. I wouldn't look at it so much as a bellwether, but it's a state where Democrats controlled by seat, and it's still a Republican-leaning state, notwithstanding the fact that President Obama won there last time. Remember, that was the first time a Democratic president had won there since, I think, Johnson in 64, off the top of my head. So it's not an easy state for Democrats. You know, Evan Bayh is one person that Democrats thought could, you know, win that seat again. And as it was, Republicans were going to make an effort against him. I think he was going to win. So that's why it's bad news for Democrats. I still think that the Republicans have a long way to go to take control back of the Senate. I mean, the Democrats now have a 59-41 advantage there. And 9 seats are a lot of seats. Now, there are a lot of Democratic seats in play, including Harry Reid's, as you just said. But the Republicans also have to hold on to a bunch of seats as well, including, you know, where they could have problems, Kentucky, open seats, Kentucky, Missouri, Ohio, New Hampshire. So I think clearly the Democrats are going to suffer some losses and probably significant ones. I'm not quite sure they're going to lose control. But
right. A lot of retirements on both sides.
Yes, sir.
You know, Bayh's reasons for leaving were different than somebody like Senator Chris Dodd, who's also decided not to run for re-election. Dodd basically said, I've seen my numbers. They are bad. I can't win. I'd rather leave than risk losing. Evan Bayh said nothing of the sort. He just said, I can't stand the atmosphere anymore. Do we take him at his word, or does Evan Bayh know something about his prospects that we don't, and he's putting sort of the best face on it here?
Yeah, this is a question that we were wrestling with yesterday as we were reporting and writing the story.
Right.
I think the bottom line is that we do take him at his word for two reasons. One is, you know, everything we've heard is that while he might have had a difficult race, he's going to win. I mean, he was in pretty good shape. He had a lot of money. He's popular there. He's won his last two Senate races.
His last name is Bayh.
That's no small thing. He's a member of the big of a political dynasty there, which goes to the other thing. What makes his sort of announcement so remarkable and so, I think, credible, you know, I talked to him yesterday, and he's talking about when he used to go to the Senate with his father, Birch Bayh, like, you know, I think he was senator from like 69 to 83 or something like that, a long time ago, and how different he said it was then. He said senators were friends, you know, they socialized at night, and he said they really did, when push comes to shove, put aside politics, you know, when it came to dealing with a crisis. Now, there could be some kind of idealized memory there, but I think it is really true, and he's a testimony to it, to how much things have changed for the worse there. And, you know, I think the takeaway of Dodd was very much Democrats are in trouble and Dodd is in trouble. I mean, that was very clear,
right?
You know, and he was very candid about it. I think the takeaway here is that something is really wrong here when a lot of a qualified person like Bayh, whatever you think of him politically, doesn't want to be in what you would think would be one of the most prestigious jobs in the world. Right?
And already the buzz around him, Adam Nagorny, is that he may be positioning for a presidential run. We'll have to see. Republicans licking their chops about their prospects in Indiana and also licking their chops in Nevada. Lisa Mascaro, you cover the majority leader, Harry Reid, who's in a tough race. Majority leaders don't usually lose their races at home, but it can happen. How is Harry Reid polling right now?
Hi, Todd. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Sure.
You know, Reid's polling in Nevada, the outside polling that we've seen shows him just really facing an uphill battle. He's, you know, down in the almost George W. Bush territory, you know, in the 30s. Reid's own internal polling, which his campaign has not released, shows him faring better. The polling that's out there also shows Reid at this point, frankly, losing to the potential Republican matchups in the state. Again, Reid's own internal polling, says he's doing better than that. So Senator Reid faces a really uphill battle. You know, back home, it's an interesting situation. You know, he's been in office. This will be his fifth term he's seeking as a senator, and often in a small state like this, where someone has achieved so much power and clout and is able to sort of do so much for his state, that engenders them to their folks back home. And in Nevada, you kind of have the opposite effect, where there's a little bit of what people call Reid fatigue, where they kind of want to know, you know, what have you done for me lately? And, with the economy so bad in Nevada, with the foreclosure crisis and the lack of tourism really hurting the gaming industry, folks are really looking to Reid as what is your powerful position done for us?
So it's a skittish year for all incumbents. But I want to ask you about Reid's position in particular. With Congress being as unpopular as it is, I'm going to be charitable and say their approval rating is 16% at the top end.
Maybe
yeah. Celeste, you've been quoting numbers like 13,
yeah.
Abysmal. Somebody who's a majority leader is inextricably tied to that, right? He cannot separate himself from the poor approval ratings of the Congress.
Yeah, you know, I think that's right. And you've seen Republicans early on go after Reid as the majority leader from the time, even when he was the minority leader before Democrats had control of Congress in 07. Republicans really sort of putting that target on his back, hoping to do to him what they did to Senator Tom Daschle in South Dakota back in 04, really tying him to that. And I think you really see it on health care, too, where, the big health care debate, that was Reid's bill. You know, Reid eventually crafted that bill, merging those bills together. So he really has ownership of that. Some people think in an odd way that could help him in the end. But I think conventional wisdom says that, these things that people don't like coming from Washington, have Reid's name all over it.
And Harry Reid has turned the agenda now to jobs, 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 as he says it, not just a jobs bill, but a jobs agenda, trying to save the Democrats as well as himself. Lisa Mascaro, Washington correspondent for the Las Vegas Sun, and of course Adam Nagorny, chief political correspondent for the New York Times. Those are Democrats in the Senate and a skittish 2010 election. Thank you. Let's check in now on the stories we're following at 15 minutes past the hour.
American and Pakistani intelligence forces have captured the man reputed to be the second in command of the Afghan Taliban. Mullah Abdul Baradar was arrested in the Pakistani city of Karachi. Baradar oversaw the group's military operations, finances, and the leadership council. The Taliban deny he's been captured. In Afghanistan, U.S. Marines are pushing further into the Taliban stronghold of Marja. It's the fourth day of the offensive, and militants have stepped up their counterattacks. To Haiti now, the Canadian government says it will spend $12 million to build the Haitian government a temporary base. The new base will accommodate key ministries for up to a year.
Here at home in Washington State, rescuers are hoping for better conditions on Mount St. Helens so they can resume the search for a climber who fell into the crater. Officials say the effort was suspended last night because of high winds. At the Olympics, men's snowboard cross gold medalist Seth Westcott says he's excited to have won the only two gold medals ever awarded for the event.
Yes. Amazing to be able to do that as part of the history of snowboarding.
Also at the game, skier Bodie Miller won bronze in the men's alpine downhill. The U.S. leads the medal count now with 8. Finally, Iran has hit back at American accusations that it's becoming a military dictatorship. In a speech today, the Iranian foreign minister said the U.S. was promoting old militaristic approaches and fueling tensions and instability in the region. And that's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up later this hour, with the start of Mardi Gras, we're remixing Mardi Gras music from jazz to newer music. We'll take a listen at the music of Fat Tuesday later this hour, and in just a few minutes we talk about the Winter Olympics and the start of men's hockey. That's coming right up.
Hey, you want that to go?
And now some takeouts on the news stories that we're following this week. We want you to stay on top of. President Obama is facing new opposition to his plan for limiting the size of banks. The opposition is coming from the European Union. Finance ministers in the EU have united against the so-called Volcker rule, which would prevent commercial banks from owning hedge funds and taking excessive risk. The shorthand for this is kind of too big to fail, or letting the banks get entangled in too many financial instruments that got them in trouble in the first place. New York Times finance reporter and contributor to The Takeaway, Louise Story, is here with us in studio. Morning, Louise.
Morning.
Louise, What is President Obama trying to do, and frankly, why would Europe have a problem with it?
So this is known as the Volcker Rule.
The Volcker Rule.
Yes, because, you know, the former head of the Federal Reserve has proposed it, Paul Volcker. But what it says is that banks that take deposits and make loans, those very activities that we want to preserve, those are the activities that called for us to rescue banks. Banks that do those activities should not also do risky trading and own hedge funds or private equity firms. So it's calling for a separation of banking, deposit-taking, lending from risky trading.
Keeping banks a little bit in the safety zone, in other words, to do what they were meant to do.
That's what it's supposed to do. Now,
the EU has a problem with this, apparently.
Right. So Bloomberg News uncovered this memo that shows that the EU is going to be coming out, the finance minister saying that they think that this is not a good idea. And in particular, the finance ministers over in Europe are concerned that this would push risk out of the financial system. And this opens a fundamental debate. So in the U.S., the Obama proposal talks about it being good to push the risk away from these big banks, okay? Because then we won't bail out banks in the future that do these trading activities. But then in Europe, they're saying, well, we need to keep the risk in the system because that's what we monitor. That's what we can control. Mm-hmm. That's what we can handle. And the fear is that if you push things out of the system, they're in the shadows, you don't really know what's going on, and they may cause even greater risk. So it's a fundamental debate over this.
I can envision analysts down on Wall Street at the firms that you cover sort of secretly saying, yes, go EU, standing up for them at a time when maybe they can't because they're not popular enough to stand up against the Volcker Rule.
They may be rooting for that. You know, also today, Henry Paulson, the former Treasury Secretary, has an opinion piece in The Times where he talks about how important it is that we pass financial reform. And, you know, Paulson's the former CEO of Goldman, so he has both the government perspective and the banking perspective. But he said, we've got to pass the financial reform. And in particular, he says, it's very important to have a systemic risk regulator, someone who's watching all the risk. That's a proposal that's sort of fallen off the table.
Okay, but in the world, but quickly, though, if Obama succeeds here in the United States with Paulson's backing for major financial reform and Europe doesn't come along in the world of interconnected banking, what does that really mean?
Well, the EU will do their own version, of course. The fear is if one country has much harsher rules, will banks move more of their activities to other countries?
Just fly to where you can make more money because you can take more risk. All right, Louise Story, finance reporter for The New York Times and contributor here at The Takeaway. Thanks for joining us.
For our next takeout, let's go to Vancouver for the Olympics. And we're joined by Dan Friedel. He's covering the Winter Games, and he's specifically got his eye on hockey, which makes you one of about a million or so in Canada, right? I mean, if you're talking about hockey, Canadians are hockey fanatics. That must add an actual bit of excitement to the beginning of the men's hockey.
Yeah, you'd have to say there are about 30 million hockey fans here, Celeste, and they're all raring to go. You know, you just look around on the streets of Vancouver as the games have gotten started, and there are tons of Canada hockey jerseys out there, even though, as you know, the Canadian Olympic hockey players didn't even march in the opening ceremony.
Well, you know, a lot of people in the United States, of course, are looking to the U.S. team, but they struggled to get a seventh-place finish in Torino. Can we expect the U.S. team to make a good showing in the Olympics?
Well, Brian Burke, who is the kind of bombastic figurehead of a general manager for the USA team, has made it clear that he looked for a team this year that I wouldn't say was bereft of all-stars, but was kind of filled with a new breed of player. And the idea is that he wanted to have guys who didn't mind being the brick and mortar so that the team might be a little bit tougher and grittier and wasn't looking just for all the glory, that they were willing to do the hard work. And, you know, the team is clearly not a favorite because you've got such a star-studded group of teams from countries like Canada and Russia and Sweden. But, you know, they'll probably have a shot to make it into the bronze medal game.
Well, they're facing off against the Swiss today, and that's going to be a tough fight against the Swiss. They've got a great hockey team out there. You know, you talk about all-star hockey players and bright stars in the sport, but we're not talking about pampered athletes here.
Well, just hours ago, when I was coming back from a hard day of work yesterday, I was on the SkyTrain, which is what they call the metro or subway here in Vancouver, with three of the players from the Slovakian hockey team. I mean, this is like Brooklyn Dodgers in the 20s and 30s, where you're riding the streetcar with the guys who you're about to go see in, you know, 30,000, 40,000 seat stadium.
Pro athletes on public transportation.
Yeah, and it was the same thing when I arrived on Sunday at the airport, where the biggest star of them all, Alex Ovechkin from the Russian team and the Washington Capitals, was up on the conveyor belt at the Vancouver International Airport, grabbing these giant hockey bags for his Russian and Washington Capitals teammates that had all just arrived from their road trip, the last road trip before the NHL went on its break. And he was, you know, smiling like a kid on Christmas morning, you know, with all these bags to grab off of the conveyor. And I went up to him and I said, you know, don't you have an assistant who's going to do that for you? And he kind of smiled and said, I don't need an assistant for this. You know,
I can get it myself.
Happy to be there.
Yeah. Dan Friedel's a freelance sports writer. He's up in Vancouver covering the Olympics. The U.S. team is going to face off against the Swiss hockey team today. We're going to have more Olympic coverage all week long. You can check out our Olympic coverage at thetakeaway.org. Coming up, the difference between a kill or capture order when it comes to the Taliban. I'm Celeste Headley, and I have Todd Zwillick with me this week. He's filling in for John Hockenberry. Coming up, there's a standing presidential order to kill or capture Taliban members, but it turns out more Taliban members have been killed than captured. We're going to talk about the implications of that strategy in just a few moments. First, here's some of the news stories you're following at 30 minutes after the hour. U.S. officials say they've captured the Taliban's second-in-command. Mullah Abdul Baradar, the group's top military commander, was captured more than a week ago in Pakistan during a joint Pakistani and American raid. Some of the world's top terrorism experts have been weighing the significance of his capture. Professor Rohan Gunaratna is the head of Singapore's Terrorism Center.
His capture will make it much easier for Pakistan and the United States and the Afghan government to talk to Afghan Taliban, because this is the ideal time, because they are under military pressure, and also this man has been arrested.
Baradar is being interrogated in Pakistan, where officials hope he'll provide the whereabouts of Mullah Omar, the Taliban's founder and spiritual leader. Meanwhile, across the border in Afghanistan, the battle for the city of Marja continues into its fourth day. In pockets of the city, the Taliban is stepping up counterattacks as U.S. forces proceed with caution in order not to harm civilians. Three civilians were killed during yesterday's fighting.
In Saudi Arabia now, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has told college students that if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, it could trigger a nuclear arms race in the Middle East. Her appearance at the all-women's college was highly unusual in the conservative Muslim nation. Saudi law bars women from voting or driving without permission from a male guardian. Here at home, more than 30 members of Congress are expected to attend the funeral of late Congressman John Murtha later this morning. The Western Pennsylvania Democrat died last week at the age of 77 after complications after gallbladder surgery. Moving on to markets now, Asian and European markets are up. Futures are up as well. The Dow gets underway at 10,099. The S&P opens at 1,075. And the NASDAQ opens at 2183 this morning. Those are some of the stories we're following.
As we've been reporting all morning, the military leader of the Taliban, Mullah Abdul Baradar, has been captured. He's reportedly under interrogation in the 10 days since U.S. and Pakistani intelligence forces nabbed him in Karachi. Baradar was taken alive, but on many occasions, President Obama and members of his administration have boasted not just of capturing, but of killing terrorists. Here's Vice President Joe Biden this Sunday on NBC's Meet the Press with another way of saying it.
We're pursuing that war with a vigor like it's never been seen before. We've eliminated 12 of their top 20 people. We have taken out 100 of their associates.
Eliminating terror suspects, taking them out. That's part of a new policy, a strategy from the Obama administration. We're going to take a closer look at this with Kenneth Anderson. He's a member of the Hoover Task Force on National Security and Law, and he's also a law professor at American University. Also joining us is Michael Hurley. He's a senior counsel on the 9/11 Commission and director of the Commission's counterterrorism policy. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Kenneth, let's start with you. You're an expert in things such as international human rights and terrorism. And in terms of this, it appears to be a concerted strategy to, as the vice president described, take out members of the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. Is that common as a policy of an administration? And is it legal?
Well, in the first place, I guess I'd start by saying that this is a lawful policy. That is, the ability to target lawful targets out there among the Taliban or al-Qaeda, or frankly among other terrorist groups that might exist out there, has really never been questioned as a legal matter stretching back not just to the last two administrations, the Obama administration and the Bush administration, but it goes back to Clinton and the basic idea of being able to target terrorists wherever they might be located if the state where they have taken safe haven will not do anything about them or even gives them shelter. That's a principle that the U.S. Government has always taken seriously and goes back many, many decades. So the lawfulness of this is not really, in my mind, at issue. And so then the real question is, as a strategic and as a tactic and as a method of going about counterterrorism, is this a good way to do it? In my mind, it is, and I congratulate the Obama administration for having picked up a tactic that the of going on offense that the Bush administration had initiated, but the Obama administration has really made it its signature policy. This is, from my standpoint at least, a really good thing to be doing, and it's something that they've embraced and something that they've really made their own. I know that there is a lot of criticism of it, but I certainly think that the lawfulness of it is not really an issue.
Okay, Michael Hurley.
And that it's effective.
Michael Hurley, let's direct the next question to you, because you're one of the lead coordinators on the Operation Anaconda. That was the largest military campaign against al-Qaeda in Afghanistan so far. Can you tell us a little bit about the choice between killing versus capture? To what extent is that left in the hand of military commanders on the ground? And what goes into this decision on whether to kill or whether to capture?
Commanders on the ground have more freedom in places like Afghanistan and somewhat in Pakistan, actually not so much on the ground, but from the air. A lot goes into the decisions, actually. Washington is directly involved in terms of targeting the individuals who are considered the most lethal. Ideally, you would try to capture such people for the intelligence value that they might have and be able to offer. But we don't always have the ideal situation, and I think it's important for listeners to know that this is not Hollywood. It's not a movie. Equipment breaks down. Any operation that you mount poses some really serious risks. It's probably somewhat easier to kill someone from a distance than to mount a very, very complicated capture operation that poses significant difficulties. And therefore, there's always a calculation that's made as to what's the best action to take.
And is that based on what you just described in terms of the difficulty and the possible danger in trying to capture them? Or sometimes it's made on what kind of intelligence they may have? Perhaps in the case of Baradar, it was just considered that he was a valuable enough target to take the risks.
All that is factored in. It is the intelligence value. It's the risk that's posed. Those factors are paramount in determining which of the possible options to take. In Baradar's case, I think it was fairly easy, given his importance. He was the number two in the Afghan Taliban, military commander. Also, his location appears to have been where the capture took place, in Karachi. You wouldn't use certain operations there. It would have to be very, very clandestine and very, very well orchestrated in a population center like Karachi of 15 million people.
Okay, Kenneth Anderson, you're a member of the Hoover Institution Task Force on National Security and Law. So let me ask you about the legal implications once someone has been captured. Baradar is in Pakistani custody, and they are interrogating him. But when we capture him, we know that there's a lot of complications legally on how we detain them and what we do with them.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons that we find it much more convenient to have him in Pakistani hands than in our own hands, that one of the oddities is that we've created an incentive structure at this point in which we don't have any really good options for aggressive interrogation and for extracting information and all the rest. And frankly, the Pakistanis do. Now, that may be a legal issue even for us. It And certainly if we had them in our hands, it would be a legal issue for us. And so one of the peculiarities about this that the Washington Post had picked up in their story was that there is, to some degree, not in this particular case that we're now looking at this morning, but in to some degree, there's a greater incentive to wind up killing people than capturing them, because we don't have good ways to hold them, and we don't have ways to be able to interrogate them without raising a lot of legal questions.
Kenneth Anderson, a member of the Hoover Institution Task Force on National Security and Law, and he's at the American University. We also spoke to Michael Hurley, senior counsel on the 9/11 Commission and director of the Commission's counterterrorism policy.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in this week for John Hockenberry. Today, the communist regime of North Korea celebrates the 68th birthday of their dear leader. That's Kim Jong-il. Kim Jong-il is well known for keeping his country and its citizens isolated from outside contact. Much of the country has no idea that the internet exists and has little to no communication with the global community. In fact, North Korea appears to have few signs of electricity in nighttime satellite images of the country outside of Pyongyang. But our next guest joins us with a rare peek inside of that cloistered country. The BBC's Paul Danahar has just returned from North Korea, from the capital city of Pyongyang, where he had the rare opportunity to meet with some North Korean students who may just end up being the next generation of North Korean dear leaders. Paul, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi.
So these were not just any students, we should say off the top. These were hand-picked students by the government, correct?
Well, yes and no. I mean, the universities that I was allowed into are the ones where the elite send their children. So I went to Kim Jong-il's old university, which is a Kim Il-sung university, which is about as elite as you can get. I went to the International Foreign Studies University, and I went to a teacher training university. So if you're in Pyongyang, you are already selected, because you can't live in Pyongyang unless someone lets you. And if you do something wrong, you're banished outside of Pyongyang. So anybody inside the capital is already a privileged person. Anyone who's going to university is even more privileged. And the people at the elite universities tend to be in the very top tier of the organization.
And how did you manage to get into the country in the first place? For a Western journalist to get in is so very rare.
And it took a long time. I applied about 6 months ago, and I applied to go and do a story about the English language training program that's being run between the British Council and the universities there, because I wanted to be able to go and do a story where I could talk to people directly. Because when you travel around North Korea, actually when you travel around Pyongyang, they won't let you outside of Pyongyang. I had two minders the whole time I was there. They slept in my hotel. They met me for breakfast. They took me home in the evening. I wanted to be able to talk to people in English and find out a little about their lives. So I got some access. I got to speak to people face to face. When I started straying into areas that the minders weren't happy with, they interrupted. But, you know, these people are pretty aware of what they should and shouldn't say. So obviously all their answers were slightly tempered.
And we're talking about a country where, as we said, people are cloistered from the internet, cloistered certainly from international television and radio. But you did speak to some students, as you mentioned, Paul Danahar. Let's hear one clip from what one of the students told you.
I hope to achieve speaking English, you know, so that I can go abroad and do some business, because I want to be a businessman.
Fine English for a young man who lives in a country that's cloistered.
Yeah, but funnily enough, I went to another university and they told me they were learning English by listening to the BBC World Service News. And they were doing that every day. So the elite's children do seem to be allowed to listen to some stuff. They were quite knowledgeable about the Iraq inquiry and about Britain and America's relationship. So there are some signs that perhaps they're getting ready to open up. It may take a generation, but that generation will know a bit more about the outside world than the present one does.
Did you get some confidence that these kids could wind up being citizens of the world in a way?
Well, put it like this. When I spoke to them, they talked about their aspirations of individuals. When I spoke to their faculty members, they talked about how wonderful Kim Jong-il was. So at least there's a sense that these people are thinking for themselves, at least at the moment.
Paul Danahar is BBC correspondent, Jerusalem Bureau correspondent for the BBC, but who just went to Pyongyang and had a visit with students and people in the North Korean country and was here with us to talk about it. Paul, thanks.
Good morning, I'm Celeste Headley here with Todd Zwillick, who's filling in for John Hockenberry all this week. Coming up,
call, call, stand up and get yep.
We're remixing Mardi Gras in honor of Fat Tuesday today. We're going to take you on a tour through the classics and how to enjoy New Orleans music without sounding like you don't come from New Orleans. That's coming up in a few moments. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. Pakistani officials are interrogating the man reputed to be the second in command in the Afghan Taliban. Mullah Abdul Baradar was detained in a raid by American and Pakistani agents in Karachi. Terrorism expert Professor Rohan Gunaratna says the capture is important.
Mullah Baradar was in charge of the insurgency in the south of Afghanistan. So as he's the number two of the Afghan Taliban, this arrest is very significant.
In Afghanistan, U.S. Marines are pushing further into the south of into the Taliban stronghold of Marja. It's the fourth day of the offensive, and militants have stepped up their counterattacks. Back at home, Republicans say they don't believe Senator Evan Bayh's reasons for leaving Congress. The Democratic senator from Indiana says he won't seek a third term in office because he's had it with constant partisan bickering.
I love working for the people of Indiana. I love helping our citizens make the most of their lives. But I do not love Congress.
GOP Chairman Michael Steele says Bayh isn't running because he doesn't want to face his constituents.
Today, President Obama is expected to announce an $8.3 billion loan guarantee to build two nuclear power plants in the state of Georgia. The project would create around 3,500 jobs during construction. It would be the first nuclear reactors constructed in close to three decades. At the Olympics, skier Bodie Miller captured bronze in the men's alpine downhill. He says it was an incredible experience.
I was nervous and excited and fired up, all the things you're supposed to be at the Olympics. So obviously it would have been great to be a little faster, but I was psyched. I skied hard.
Miller finished just 9/100ths of a second behind the gold medalist, and Seth Westcott overcame injuries to take the gold in snowboard cross. Those victories bring the total U.S. medal count to 8. That's 3 more than any other country at the Games. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Carnival time, at least for a little while longer. It is Fat Tuesday today, and this year Mardi Gras parades are going to celebrate the continued resurrection of New Orleans and the victory of the Saints in the Super Bowl, but try to imagine all that going on without music going on behind it. Grammy Award-winning jazz artist Terrence Blanchard and Nick Spitzer join us now. Nick Spitzer is host of the New Orleans-based public radio show American Roots. They're going to remix Mardi Gras for us. Terrence, let's start with you. You're from New Orleans. Your name
yes,
is
ma'am.
Synonymous with the city that you come from in some ways. We just heard Carnival Time by Al Jolson. Johnson. One of the things that that many people often say about New Orleans is you can kind of tell what the date is by what music is being played because it's so associated with the times of year.
Oh, it is. It is. I mean, that's one of the things that's interesting about some of the stuff that you're going to play. I mean, when you listen to Al Johnson, that kind of set his classic, well, it's Carnival Time, sets the tone for me and sets the period from where it was created. But the interesting thing about Mardi Gras music to me is that when you look at all of these different generations of artists who have created their own versions of this celebration, it is a chronicling of the development of music and the Mardi Gras celebration itself.
Oh, that's interesting. We asked you to pick out a song that kind of showed the different influences in this genre of Mardi Gras music. This one is actually about an Indian chief. It's mostly instrumental. It's called Big Chief by Professor Longhair. Why did you pick this song as a big influence on Mardi Gras music?
This is a classic. I mean, you know, this is one of those tunes in New Orleans, man. I don't think you can grow up in New Orleans without ever hearing this thing. You would have to. I think most people around New Orleans will know the song without knowing the name. It's that familiar. When I was a kid, we always wanted to be able to whistle like whistle like Professor Longhair.
I wanted to be able to whistle Sweet Georgia Brown, like the Harlem Globetrotters song. Nick Spitzer, your host of American Roots. Can you tell us kind of what are the characteristics of music that's associated with Mardi Gras? How do we know if a song is a Mardi Gras tune?
Well, they often have march beats going with parades and second lines and that sort of thing. And then some of them are little narratives of what the life is like at Mardi Gras, like Carnival Time, or you hear the Dixie Cups doing Ico, Ico, also out of the Mardi Gras Indians tradition. I think it's interesting that both Terrence and I focus on Mardi Gras Indians, that is the African-American, Afro-Creole marching groups, men dressed in these sort of expansive Great Basin West costumes. And so you hear about the Big Chief, and they're singing about you know, this is the day to be big, to be the big man. And there's Rex and the fancy parades uptown, but to be the big chief in the neighborhood is to say, I'm important too.
Well,
so
you
the lyrics are important.
Well, you picked, as you said, another one in talking about Indians. This is My Indian Red, your pick, recorded in the 1940s by Daniel Barker and Baby Dodd's Band.
The flag, boy, but watch that crazy wild man, the wildest in the lowlands, and you love our queen, queen of New Orleans.
Nick Spitzer, is the era of the big bands in the 1940s, is that considered the golden era of Mardi Gras music?
No, I think a golden era of Mardi Gras music is whenever you're at Mardi Gras in any time or place. I mean, right now we've got all kinds of great mixes of Mardi Gras music happening and new versions, as Terrence is saying. And I just happen to love Danny Barker, and that's a little band that he put together actually in the late 40s. And it runs down all the characters, the queen, the spy boy, the big chief, the wild man. And it gives a kind of an upbeat New Orleans traditional jazz version of it. But you can hear, you know, hip-hop and bounce versions of the songs about the Indians and contemporary brass bands. And so the Indians go on and are a big part of Mardi Gras from the streets out.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Cajun music, because you certainly can't talk about New Orleans music without touching on the Cajuns. This is the Balfa Brothers. This is Danse de Mardi Gras. Terrence, one of the things that's great about New Orleans music is that the city itself is so diverse, and the musicians, I guess you could politely say borrow, but they steal all these influences from every kind of music that they're hearing.
Well, that's the part of the culture here. When you talk about gumbo, that's exactly what gumbo is. You know, gumbo is, you know, bringing together whatever you have to make something that's very tasty and delightful for everybody to share. When you started talking about, you know, the Cajuns, the first thing that came to my mind was all of this music, the thing that it has in common is the celebration, you know, the coming together of all different types of cultures to celebrate this moment right before we have to give everything up.
That's right, sugar
days.
And everything else. Nick Spitzer, I'm gonna play for you one of Terrence's songs. This is actually off his recent album, and the song is called New World. Nick, is this Mardi Gras music?
It can be if it's played around Mardi Gras, and also, you know, Terrence is very evocative about things. The new world and the way Mardi Gras happens here, it reflects the Mediterranean, the Atlantic, the French, the Spanish, and of course West Africa mingling in the Caribbean and South America, whether it's Rio, Bahia, or back up here in New Orleans. And so when Terrence does it, he does it with authority from New Orleans, and when he makes that music, he's stating New World and Mardi Gras celebration. Whether you hear the old carnival melody or not, it's really how people use the music and celebrate with it.
Well, Terrence, New Orleans music is, and Mardi Gras music is certainly not set in stone. This is a genre that's constantly changing, and we kind of heard that with the Yin Yang Twins stand up and crunk, that it's so associated with the victory of the Saints, and because right. It came at carnival time is maybe also right. Associated with Mardi Gras now. Is that that kind of sound that's gonna last?
Well, it's very interesting, like, you know, Nick was just talking about the whole thing about the transformation of the celebration itself is kind of represented by this particular song, because it was first of all associated with the Saints. They were playing it at the games every Sunday, and then when we started Mardi Gras this season with the Saints Parade, we heard this song just about on every float that passed by. You know, so now you start to hear the song on all of these other parades, and it starts to become like a Mardi Gras favorite.
Well, we'll see.
And you got to know, the Saints all paraded last night at Orpheus. We're all on one float. Reggie Bush are all signing caps. I mean, the Super Bowl victory became carnival. I mean, carnival's
yes.
Every year, you know, but we haven't had a Super Bowl or any big victory in 42 years. So we don't know when that'll come back. So that's almost like been put as icing on top of the carnival cake this year. It's all been enfolded together. And that's a black-white team, run beautifully, plays beautifully, and everyone feels carnival happy about it.
Nick Spitzer, host of American Roots, a weekly public radio program about American music. It's produced out of New Orleans. And Terrence Blanchard, Grammy Award-winning jazz musician, also out of New Orleans. Thanks so much to you.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.